Chapter 17. Echidon. An arc of lightning struck the floor in front of Echidon. Blackness swallowed his sight for a second. He ducked aside on instinct. A bolt round exploded where he had been. Shrapnel rang on his armor. He surged to his feet. The air was thick in his lungs, burning his skin inside his armor. Voices filled his ears, screaming, laughing, gurgling, overlapping. The sounds of battle seemed far off for an instant. Then his sight returned, as though a cloth had been pulled from his face. Light boiled through the throne room. Muzzle flare sliced through the darkness. Sheets of actinic light flashed. He saw a Lupercai launch itself at one of the Justerin, jaws split wide, talons extended. The black-clad Terminator fired at the demonkin. A spear of fire ripped through the Lupercai the instant before it struck. Burning ichor and bone blasted out. It landed. The edges of its talons were white with heat as they sliced through the black armor. Bloody smoke caught the strobing glare of gunfire as the pair fell, locked together. And on the scene went, half-demons and warriors in black running to murder each other beneath the closed eyes of their Primarch. Malachus lay at Horus's feet, a hand raised to rest on his master's foot. The maw wound had opened in the War Master's side. Blood covered the steps beneath them, draining from War Master and Equerry alike. Fire and the flash of void shields curtained the view through the crystal window behind them. Echidon froze as his gaze touched Horus. His substance was thin, like an image projected into smoke, flickering in and out of being. A power blade flashed at the edge of his sight, and he twisted in time to step back from a descending axe. Two Justerin were closing on him, hacking heavy killing blows as he stepped back. He fired the last three rounds into the Terminators, aiming into their central mass, hoping to stagger them. They did not pause, and he found himself pushed back to the foot of the bloody throne. "Traitor!" called one of the Justerin. "Defiler!" Echidon parried a blow with the flat of his own axe, and felt force rip through his arm as the power fields of the two weapons met. The snarls of chain blades and Lupercai rose against the laughter seeping into his thoughts. The doors at the far end of the chamber began to open. Lines of fire poured through the widening crack. Echidon could see warriors in storm green with bronze faceplates charging in the van of more Terminators in coal black. The Justerin facing Echidon sensed the moment of distraction and lashed a blow at his head. He twitched aside and cut back, but the Justerin stepped into the blow. Shards of black ceramite exploded out as Echidon's axe sheared through the edge of a shoulder guard. The Justerin rammed his weight forwards. Echidon felt his chest plate crack under the impact, pain shooting through him as he fell back against the steps to the throne. The image of the bleeding Primarch looked down on him with sightless eyes, a cadaver where a king of conquest had once sat. Malachurst's face was a hand reach away, his eyes open but staring at nothing, seeing nothing.
"You have the right idea, boy,"
he had growled as he broke Echidon's knife hand, long ago, in the dark of Chthonia's underworld. The splintered tip of Echidon's knife projected from the bone just under Malachurst's eye. Blood rolled down his cheek.
"You will do," he laughed. "You will do."
Echidon tried to rise, but a boot crashed into his chest. More pain. He looked up at the face of Falcus Kyber as he aimed his bolter.
"Traitor!"
growled the Widowmaker. His armor was battle-damaged and still held the frost sheen of teleport residue. At his shoulder stood Horus Axamand, eyes cold fire in his skin-mask face. The twin circles of the gun barrels filled Echidon's gaze. He was aware that the wash of battle sound had quietened. He grinned up at the barrels and waited for them to swallow him. A wall of force slammed the Justerin commander back. The air shimmered with ghostlight as Tormageddon slid into view. Arcs of cold fire ran over his armor. Echidon started to rise.
"Leave him," said the demon host,
the word a dry rattle pulled from unused vocal cords. Echidon pushed himself up. Kyber raised his bolter to fire at Tormageddon.
"No."
The word hammered into Echidon. His muscles froze. Gunfire ceased. Noise vanished.
"No, my sons,"
said the voice again. Ecadon felt his head turn. Frost was blooming over the iron of the throne. The air swam with heat. High, distant screams filled Ecadon's skull. The War Master opened his eyes. Furnace fire burned beneath the lids. He stood. Shards of frozen blood fell from him like scattered rubies. The maw in his side was closed, the armor flawless. Ghost images of wailing faces danced and spun around him, and the shadows of cadaverous hands brushed his armor as he stepped down from the dais. His form blurred in Ecadon's eyes, color, light, and shadow flickering like the image from a damaged pict feed. He could not breathe, and he could not look away.
"My sons," spoke Horus,
his voice echoing in Ecadon's skull, obliterating the voice of his own thoughts.
"You have doubted, and you have feared."
Every figure in the room knelt as Horus stepped between Ecadon, Kyber, and Axamand. The great warlords were on their knees, pressing themselves down into the cold metal, as though held by the hands of heaven. Even Tormageddon had shrunk, its horned head bowed, as though it were a dog under the gaze of a great wolf.
"But now, all doubt and fear die," spoke Horus.
The words in Ecadon's mind blurred into the air, rolling with the sound as the War Master stood above them.
"All shall burn," he said aloud,
raising Kyber up with a claw under his chin. The Widowmaker was shaking.
"All shall be conquered."
Horus turned and looked down at Axamand. There were red tears falling from little Horus's eyes.
"And all shall kneel."
He walked between the abased warriors and grovelling demon breed. Ecadon felt as though his head would explode, as though his muscles would crumble to dust. He wanted to run. He wanted to plead for mercy. He wanted to murder and laugh and live and see his star ascend in a golden age that was yet to come.
"Rise, my sons," said Horus.
Ecadon stood. Pain and damage drained away from him. All the others stood as one, their eyes locked on Horus, who turned and looked at the rippling void light beyond the great viewport. His eyes were cold and black now, mirrors to the battle beyond.
"We end this now," he said. "And then we go to Alanor."
Ecadon thought he saw the shadow of a smile on the face.
"My brothers wait for me. And then a reckoning waits for all of us."
Horus strode towards the doors, lightning already wreathing his taloned hand. The sons of Horus followed him, and a choir of the damned sang in his wake. Argonis. The Conqueror was the first to turn. The World Eater's flagship accelerated to meet the Ultramarines. Macrofire danced off its shields. Then its sisters followed, roaring in its wake to meet their enemy head-on. Two died in as many seconds, as coordinated fire ripped through already damaged hulls. The battle barge Victory's Monument turned to meet the wild charge, pulling an octet of destroyers with it. The Conqueror lashed fire at it in response, battering its shields like a warrior goading an enemy to come closer. Above the Arc of Deluge, Perturabo's Grand Fleet held steady in tight formation, thrusters firing as they maintained their station. The first Longburn torpedoes began to explode amongst them. Plasma submunitions burst against hulls in spheres of sunfire. The Iron Warriors fired in turn, gridding the dark with short-range munitions to swallow the oncoming ordnance. The Ultramarines' fleet began to spread wider, flattening into a disk that pressed the World Eaters and Iron Warriors between it and the system's core. At the thick center of the disk rode the fleet's heaviest guns. Watching the tactical output expand across his helmet display, Argonis found himself thinking of the pit fights of the World Eaters, of the fighters who would cast a net to snare their opponents before driving a trident into their chest. Around him, gunships were lifting into the sky. Slab-sided bulk carriers swallowed blocks of World Eaters. Demons snarled at their backs, their cries growing weaker as their bodies dissolved into the mud. Above them circled Angron. The rage rolling off him peeled red streaks through the air.
In!
Growled Forex, pulling at his shoulder. And then they were running for the ramp of a Stormbird, as its engines rose to a scream pitch. It began to lift before the ramp closed behind him.
Recommend fleet distribution for breaching the enemy line,
said Forex, handing Perturabo a data slate. Perturabo gave a single shake of his head.
No, he said. We do not just run. Angron needs blood, and so we will give it to him.
The red of the compartment lights poured across the torn surface of his armor. In the pooling shadow, the metal seemed less like plates than scales, the rents shrinking to wounds in the dark. Perturabo's hand danced over the data slate, and then he handed it to Forex.
Transmit these orders to all units in orbit.
To the World Eaters?
All units, said Perturabo. We will pour blood and fire into the void.
Forex glanced at the slate, then slotted it into a wall socket. A heartbeat later, Argonis saw the order stream unfold in his helm display. It almost stopped the breath in his lungs.
This is suicide, he breathed.
Only if the demons lied, said Perturabo.
His eyes were still and unblinking, gleaming black in the red light. The Iron Warrior's ships began to move as the gunships swarmed into their hangars. Engines lit and began to shunt them closer together. Fire lashed out from those nearest the Ultramarines. Volleys sheeted into the killing mass of ships as it closed. The outer parts of the enemy fleet began to turn inwards, enveloping their prey. Perturabo's order signals began to cascade through the World Eaters' ships. Some of them began to turn and drop closer to the Iron Warriors. Others ploughed on heedlessly, slashing at the enemy ships with rolling volleys of fire.
Those ships will be lost, said Argonis.
The gunship was rising to meet the Iron Blood as the great ship cut through the blisters of explosions. Perturabo looked unmoved.
3/4 of the World Eaters report readiness, said Forex, and the Conqueror confirms that Angron is aboard.
How many of the 12th remain on the surface? Asked Perturabo.
Impossible to estimate, said Forex. Some, certainly. Their discipline
we do not wait, said Perturabo.
The gunship shook as it slammed down onto the hangar deck.
Begin the process. All ships keyed to my command.
The Conqueror,
began Forex.
The Conqueror will obey or it will die, said Perturabo. They can read the consequences. The choice is theirs.
The hatch opened, and Perturabo was striding out into the gloom of a hangar bay, slashed with stab beams. Argonis noticed that he moved fluidly, as though neither flesh nor armor had been damaged. Argonis felt the vibration in the deck increase as he stepped from the gunship. Far beneath his feet, the ship's plasma reactor output began to peak. In the void, the Ultramarines fleet was now a hand enclosing the World Eaters and Iron Warriors. Fire reached out in every direction to meet them. If the commanders of the enemy ships wondered at why the Iron Warriors did not focus their fire and try to punch through, it did not stop them. The net closed. Ships began to die. The Stonebreaker took a Nova Shell cluster from the Seneca and cracked open down its length. Fire rolled through its compartments and deep decks. The strike was only partial, and the secondary shells exploded in the void around its burning hull. It might have survived, until the fires found an ordnance magazine in its hull. The explosion split its carcass open and scattered the remains into a white-hot cloud of gas and debris. The Ultramarines' battleship Banner of Truth was the first to strike a close blow at the Iron Warriors. Bombardment arrays flared as they loosed munitions before it. Miniature stars exploded amongst the iron-skinned ships as they began to return fire, but the Banner of Truth was an old crusader, and it shrugged away their rebukes with a glitter of void shields. The Strontium Dawn turned to meet the Ultramarine ship, holding position until the two were ripping shields and then armor apart with point-blank shell and rocket fire. Atmosphere bled from both ships as they hammered each other. The World Eater's heavy frigate, Deathcut, broke formation and drove towards the pair. Boarding torpedoes shot from its prow and punched into the Banner of Truth's keel. World Eaters poured into the ship's lower decks. Blood and shouts of panic flowed through the ratings as the sound of chain axes screamed above the battle sirens. The Death Cut pressed on, ramming its prow across the banner of Truth's bridge. The two ships spun away, tumbling, firing on each other like two enemies hacking at each other as they fell from a cliff. The first concentrated volleys began to strike the Iron Blood. Its prow and spine shields fell in a rolling flash. Gunnery officers on the ultramarine ships cycled their batteries, racing to fire on the great vessel before it could raise its void envelope again. Fighting a ship of its size was never about single killing blows. They were simply too huge, too heavily armored and shielded. You had to wear them down, to land strike after strike against its main mass until it died of its wounds. That was what the captains and gunnery commanders had predicted and planned for. But the Iron Blood shields were not raised again. Instead, the Ultramarine's Auspex saw reactor spikes across the Iron Warriors and World Eaters' ships. Thinking that their prey was about to try to break through their net, they poured power into their own engines. The gap closed. The Iron Blood turned slowly in a growing cloak of fire. Beside it, the Conqueror dropped into formation so that the two huge ships were within a kilometre of each other. "The warp engines are ready," said Forex, as Perturabo reached his strategium. Argonis watched the Lord of Iron pause, then nod.
"Give the order."
Forex bowed his head and turned, speaking into the vox. A second later, the alert lights flicked from pulsing amber to cold blue. The vibration in the deck was now a high, teeth-itching buzz. Argonis closed his eyes briefly, and for the first time felt himself hope that the dark gods were watching over them. Warp translation was not a matter of mechanics. The engines and calculations that allowed ships to rip a hole into the Sea of Souls were a veneer of science over a process that was, in essence, the violation of reality. What seemed rules were little more than reassurance to human minds. One of those rules was that warp translation should only ever be attempted far from the gravity of planets and stars. To disobey that rule was to risk the creation of an unstable rift between worlds, a hungering wound that would draw all it could reach into the beyond. The navigators realized what was happening first. Across the Ultramarine's fleet, they began to shout into the vox. Transmechanics burbled shock and incredulity. Captains began to issue frantic orders to turn, for drives to reverse. Power flushed to engines as some of the Ultramarine's fleet scattered across the void. Others, though, ploughed on, their commanders heedless or unaware of the danger. Space began to crackle with multicolored lightning. Lesions formed in the skin of reality and ruptured to glittering voids. Impossible wings churned through the vacuum as hurricanes of blue and green fire danced over the ships of the World Eaters and Iron Warriors. In the heart of the Iron Blood, Argonis's hearts stopped beating. He felt as though his skin were being dragged back into his flesh. A single high-pitched note filled his ears, shrieking louder and louder. The void split. The holes opened in reality, ripped wide, flowing together until a ragged grin ran through the arc of Deluge's orbit. Vast eyes and teeth rippled at the edge of the wound. It sat for an instant, both present and an illusion. Then it inhaled. Ships tumbled into the beyond, vast hulls spinning over and over like splinters in a storm. Creatures with mist bodies and howling mouths clawed and bit at their hulls. Down and down and through into nothingness the ships fell. Howling wheels of flame tore apart the Ultramarine's vessels. Bodies spilled into the raw tides of chaos. Those that were lucky found the claws of waiting carrion demons. The rest fell on, their flesh dissolving and distorting as their souls screamed in torment. And through the whirl and babble, the Iron Blood and the Conqueror fell on. Their sisters tumbled with them, their hulls shimmering in the ghostlight, untouched by claw or storm. On the outside of the Conqueror's bridge, the figure of Angron pulled itself up to the highest point of the hull. His body was a hunched mass of muscle, his wings a vast cloak streaming in the raw winds of the warp. He straightened, his form still holding the image that he bore in the mortal realm. Swarms of the Neverborn spiraled close, calling out, the lesser predators honoring the apex of their kind. Angron raised his arms. Around him, the dead of the sundered Ultramarines fleet were red shadows. The false substance of his muscle frayed from him as he tilted back his head and roared in victory and summons. The storm tides crashed in and bore the ships away in their claws, clutched like infants in a mother's arms. Through the warp, the World Eaters heard the Red Angels' cry and cast their ships into the storm tides. Lyak.
This is it, said Fulgrim.
He appeared to breathe, nostrils flaring, torso swelling. He raised his forearms, palms open, head thrown back, white mane of hair tumbling back down his shoulders.
Alanor. Oh, what fair mother of honour! Oh, what cradle of glory!
He let out the breath, and the lids which had hidden his eyes opened. He lowered his arms and his chin, and spat. Rocks sizzled and burned where the black phlegm landed.
Tastes past its best.
Lord Commander Eidolon made a hooting burst of sound that might have been a laugh. Lorgar glanced at the Emperor's children officer, then looked away without speaking. Beside Eidolon stood a disordered group of riotously coloured warriors, all of them bearing bulky weapons with wide grinning barrels and tangles of chromed pipe. They had not questioned the manner of their lord's return once their ships had exited the warp alongside Lorgar's fleet. They had just accepted it and celebrated with slaughter. More was still arriving every hour, children returning to their father's call. Lyak looked away. 100 warriors of his own chapter ringed their position. Other than he and Lorgar himself, the rest remained in orbit, while the Primarchs came to look at the last place that the Imperium had been unified. Actea had not been seen since the passage through the warp. Lorgar had not mentioned her absence, and Lyak had the feeling that the Primarch viewed her as a tool that had done its work and required no more thought. Rain fell from the iron sheet of the sky. He watched the water run from Lorgar's armour, grey drops on crimson. Ahead, the plateau reached away to the horizon, its features beaten flat, its skin carved by rain. The prints of landing craft and war machines still marked the ground. From the air, he had looked down and seen the patterns of the great camps where legions and armies had landed and been drawn up, their memory still lingering on the grey ground. Water churned at the bottom of shallow gullies between flat expanses of shattered rock. Pools had formed in depressions and reflected the wan daylight back up at the sky above. Small drifts of debris dotted the ground. A neat stack of fuel drums, rusted to a dull orange. The track of a battle tank, lying like a shed snakeskin. The skeleton of some grand marquee, the last of its fabric hanging in sodden tatters from its poles. Behind them, the Imperial dais rose to touch the flat iron sky. Muck streaked the white marble and rimmed the eyes of the statues with gritty shadows. There was no mould growing on the stones, though, despite the damp, and Lyak had seen nothing growing on the plateau as they flew across it. Orbital imaging had detected flora and fauna creeping back into some of the temperate equatorial regions, but the work done by war and then the cold hand of the Mechanicum almost 2 decades before held. Alanor remained a barren land, a grave marker laid at the heart of a dead empire. The wind threaded through the dais's arches and high walkways, keening long shrill notes through the wet air.
There is no one here,
gurgled Eidolon.
All the better if we mean to actually kill our brother once he arrives, said Fulgrim.
Lorgar shot him a look.
What? Said Fulgrim with a needle-toothed grin. Did you think I would keep it from my children? Loyalty for them is personal. I think most of them will rather enjoy murdering Horus.
You will, won't you, my pretty little reborn one?
Eidolon growled. Then Lyak felt the sound somehow shake his flesh inside his armour.
Ah, pride, crooned Fulgrim. What sweetness is thy gift of pain?
Eidolon turned away, his movements somehow both uncoordinated and fluid. Lyak watched his eyes contract and bulge as he looked across the ground.
Wait for an attempt before someone else gets you,
gurgled Eidolon. Someone else is here. Look, said Lorgar. He raised his hand to point, and the cluster of mortals and demigods turned to look. A figure stood on the lower tiers of the dais. The rain ran from the cold blue of his armour. He did not move as they looked at him. Fulgrim bared his teeth.
Oh, he breathed. I didn't think that he would be here. How wonderful.
Mouth of Legion,
gurgled Eidolon.
Were you hoping that Horus would arrive before we had the inconvenience of wondering if our other brothers and their sons will back your play for the crown?
Lorgar looked at the still figure on the dais. Perturabo and Angron will not arrive in time, if both arrive at all. Mortarion has already been ordered to Terra.
Are you so sure?
Purred Fulgrim. Lorgar did not answer but stepped towards the figure.
Identify yourself, he called.
I am Alpharius, came the reply.
Of course,
said Fulgrim with a chuckle. Then he looked at Lorgar and shrugged.
But on the other hand, he could be...
There are no signs of them on the planet or in orbit,
hooted Eidolon.
There wouldn't be, said Lorgar softly, eyes still fixed on the lone figure.
It could complicate things, said Eidolon.
Lorgar shot a hard look at the former Lord Commander.
Begin the deployment, he said. Everything we have, arrayed in formal order. Weapons loaded and ready.
Talking of complications,
gurgled Eidolon. They all looked at him.
Ships have just entered the system and are making fast speed directly for us. We heard them leave the great ocean. Such a clamour.
Who? Snapped Lyak. Eidolon looked at him. Air sacs in the commander's throat filled and deflated slowly.
Who else? It is the vengeful spirit. The sons of Horus are here. The Warmaster is here.
Lyak felt cold circle his gut, though he was not sure why.
Proceed as planned, said Lorgar a second later.
Make all the preparations. We cut him down here when he descends to greet us. Lyak held the leashes of Fulgrim's bonds tight until the demon Primarch bowed his head.
As you will it, brother. As you will it.
Lorgar turned away and walked across the grey plain. Lyak watched him for a long second, before remembering the figure who had been standing on the dais. He looked up, but the one who had claimed the name Alpharius was nowhere to be seen.